This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
People go for social reasons, emotional reasons, intellectual reasons, spiritual reasons. We suspect from all these surveys and so on what it is that they might actually be seeking. That is only going to lead to growth in your business.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 40. We have reached another milestone in the numbers of shows that we have recorded. So we really appreciate you joining us. If this is your first time with the Simon Dell Show, then welcome. And thank you very much for listening in. If you're a return visitor, then thank you for coming back. The format has changed recently. We are now just doing our interviews within the show and the spin cycle episodes that include a lot of stuff from Patrick and Edwina and a lot of swearing and insults do have their own show because we just felt that that was a better place to put them. So, but today we have on the show a gentleman by the name of Michael Adams. He is a Kiwi, for those of you that will pick up on his accent straight away. He's born and bred in New Zealand, where he has done a number of years working for the Auckland Theatre Company. He did a few roles there, including the marketing communications manager, marketing and sponsorship manager, director of marketing, and so on, before he arrived a couple of years ago in Brisbane, where he became the marketing and communications director for the Brisbane Festival. Now, I'm not going to waste my time and explaining what the Brisbane Festival is, because if you're in Brisbane, you know exactly what the Brisbane Festival is. And if you're not in Brisbane, you're probably going to need to look at the website. So I would encourage you to do that before you listen to what Michael has to say. It's www.brisbanefestival.com.au. He talks a lot about his experience through the arts and theatre and marketing those, also his sales experience early on in his career. But I think one of the most important and interesting things he talks about is the way that the Brisbane Festival deals with segmenting their data and their user data. Now, that might not sound very sexy, very exciting, but from a marketing perspective, the lengths that they're going to understand their target market is something that I think every business should learn from. So listen to Michael, lot to learn. He does like to talk, which is not a bad thing, but very entertaining and very informative. On top of that, what else do I need to say? So we've also got, if you could possibly go and rate and review us on iTunes, that would be fantastic. For those of you that listened to earlier episodes will know that I managed to delete all of our reviews and ratings. So, not the smartest thing I've ever done, but, if you could go and add one in, that'd be fantastic. If you'd like to get hold of myself or my business partner, Matt, we do a digital consulting for businesses all over the world, then come and talk to us, simon@simondell.com. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. The simondell.com is our Instagram page. And finally, I have about just over 2 weeks left before I become a father for the second time. So a big countdown for me, probably some sleepless nights and probably a few weeks missed of podcasts. Although I'm building a bank up in the next 6 weeks of a huge amount of people that I'm interviewing this week and next week. So hopefully there should be no interruptions before Christmas. But anyway, that's pretty much all from me. And we'll jump straight into the interview with Michael Adams. So welcome, Michael Adams, to the Simon Dell Show. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me on. It's exciting.
Now, just for those people who aren't in Brisbane, I think it's probably worth you giving us the quick elevator pitch of exactly what is the Brisbane Festival.
Sure. So Brisbane Festival is an annual festival. It's the largest event in Queensland of its kind. Actually, I think it's the largest event full stop in Queensland. We have a mixture, as many of the people listening to your podcast would probably be aware of, other major arts festivals around Australia, like Adelaide and Perth and Sydney and Melbourne and so on. We have a program very similar to their program. In addition to that, because of our unique history, we also have on our final night a very large fireworks display called Sunsuper River Fire, which also has a little bit of an aerial show from the Australian Defence Force. So we're a large cultural festival with a extra spectacle and a very kind of large public community event attached to the end.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's a government funded organisation, or is there funding come from sort of all different places?
Funding does come from different places. We're an initiative of Brisbane City Council and the Queensland State Government. About 20 years ago, there were two different festivals in Brisbane. Sunsuper River Fire was one of them in and of itself. And there's another festival called the River Festival, which was the arts festival. One was owned by state government, one was owned by council. Those two things were joined together and then that was branded as Brisbane Festival. We're funded principally by those two shareholders, but we have a number of other smaller funders and a very large corporate sponsorship kind of revenue stream as well. We get about $3 million in cash, and then I think another $6 million in contributions to the festival.
Right, right. So, for those who don't know, it's obviously a big
event.
Concern.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
It's not a little weekend party or anything. Like
no, that. No. We go for 22 days. We have about 70 productions. We have two of our own precincts, which have multiple venues in them, and then we use 17 other venues around the city. So, it is quite a big logistical event.
We'll come on to a bit more about that later on, but
sure.
What I kind of want to do for those of you that aren't in Australia and or those of you who also aren't in New Zealand, they may not identify the fact that your accent is not originally Australian, as most people will be able to identify that mine is not originally Australian.
Yeah.
You're an Auckland boy. Were you born and bred Auckland?
No, actually, I grew up in the South Island on a farm.
Okay.
And yeah, so the arts weren't actually part of my family's life.
I was going to say there wasn't much arts on a farm.
Well, we were pretty close to Christchurch, and both of my parents were academics. They'd come from large farming families and wanted to have a farm themselves. So we had a sheep stud and crop farm, but yeah, we were close to the city, so I was able to go to a lot of things, and I did a lot of kind of musical and amateur dramatic kind of performances when I was young, so that's how I kind of got into this industry, and then I started working at the professional theatre that operates in Christchurch when I was 16.
Right.
So I had good access to good training and a professional outfit to work with.
What's one of your highlights from your teenage years in the arts? Because everybody who listens would have had at some point of experience of being on stage in something they didn't want to be in.
Oh, right. Yeah. I always wanted to be in the things I wasn't.
Well, no, yeah, I was going to say a lot of people did want to be in those things, but some people got dragged into nativity plays and stuff.
Oh, yeah,
like that.
No, I never had to do those. I had to sing.
What was your highlight? What was something you look back on in those years and you know, reminisce fondly about?
I think even though I actually wasn't on stage at the time, I was working behind the scenes on Angels in America in the very first production that was presented in New Zealand. So a major Pulitzer award-winning play, and it had a lot of famous New Zealand actors in it. We have a term in New Zealand for that. It's called World Famous in New Zealand. We think everybody must know who they are, but in actual fact, only New Zealanders do. And that was a major production. It was kind of an eye-opener. I was 16. I don't know if you know the storyline of that, but it deals with...
No.
It's called a gay gay fantasia on national themes, and it deals with a lot of American politics from the 70s and the 80s and around the AIDS epidemic. And there's the central kind of characters are some Mormons who are living in New York, and it's an extraordinary play and an epic play. But I worked pretty closely on that for 3 months, so it was quite a transformative experience. It's the first time I really kind of saw how powerful and amazing theatre could be, and it was an absolute blockbuster in Christchurch when it played, because it had been such a famous play. So yeah, that was an incredible kind of eye-opening experience for me. And then a little bit.
And I'm guessing listening to you there, that was you kind of realizing, light bulb moment coming on, that was what you wanted to do from moving forward.
Yeah, it was, although I have to admit that I actually started doing medicine and then decided I really didn't want to be a doctor. And I had this idea that it was going to be my backup career should I fail to be work in the entertainment industry somewhere. And then I learned pretty quickly you have to commit if you want to work in entertainment, and medicine is really not the kind of career that you just do as a backup. It's quite all consuming, and I fainted quite a lot. So it was quite nice to get away from that.
What, you just no good with blood, or just that kind of thing?
Actually, it's more the discussion of it. I was being teased yesterday because one of the girls on my team had fallen over and had a big gash on her hand. So I was doing the first aid for it, and everybody's like, "Michael, aren't you going to faint?" So there's no problem with the side of it. It's when you're talking about how your body's leaky and there's fluid moving between your circulatory system and your immune system. And I was like, "Ah, yeah, the idea of leakiness," and then suddenly I'd be lying on the floor.
My
imagination
exactly
is too good.
I'm terrible.
Yeah, active imagination.
I've fainted at all sorts of things. It's very embarrassing.
Yeah. It's really embarrassing, and you can feel it happening, and you go all sort of fuzzy, and then you feel like you turn into rubber, and then suddenly you're on the ground, and there's nothing you can do about it, and everybody's looking at you. Yeah,
I think I fainted once having my blood pressure measured. That was
I don't like having my blood pressure taken either. And I actually my doctor, because I've got apparently slightly high blood pressure unless I'm very relaxed, but my doctor says I've got white coat syndrome, and just the idea of having a blood pressure test sends my blood pressure up.
It's very strange. Strange. I get the piss taken quite a lot out of that as well. Yeah. You spent a long time at Auckland Theatre Company. Was that and you've progressed through a few roles there. Mm-hmm. All marketing roles. What kind of got you into the marketing side of things, as opposed to the performance and the backstage side of things?
Yeah. So originally, when I trained, I trained as a director and a dramaturg, and I did a bit of producing. So producing is very much the business side of the arts. And then when I graduated from university, I had this kind of a long story involved. And although the creative industries paper that I'd taken, there was quite a lot of marketing was quite a big part of what we would do, I didn't actually think that that's what I'd end up doing. But we graduated from university, and we wanted to mount our own work. And to do that, we needed to apply for funding. And to apply for funding, you needed to have a track record to prove that you could pull off what it was that you said you were going to do. And so it seemed like a bit of a catch-22. So what we at the time decided, we had met the station manager of what's called the BNet in New Zealand. It's a student or indie radio station network in New Zealand. And they had been looking for a sales manager. A friend of mine and I pitched our services as salespeople, working entirely on commission, so there was no risk to the station. Yeah. Right. But the trade-off was that we would also write and record the ads, so that would have sort of a creative dimension to that. And it turned out that we were very successful at selling adverts, and we ended up selling not just the local station but the national station, and then we added on to that other youth-orientated print publications and street gig guides and so on. And again, we were always just working for commission. And I think in the process of doing that, because I was selling that and then taking briefs and trying to find out from local stores and local businesses what their marketing objectives were and how they were pitching themselves and positioning themselves, I kind of got a really tangible sense of what marketing was on top of the theoretical stuff that we'd done in the creative industries papers. So I got we started to run out a lot of campaigns, particularly targeting youth market through radio and print. And then somehow I think I got offered a large musical coming to New Zealand to act as a publicist, and I hadn't actually ever been a publicist before. Right. But by this stage we were making a couple of $100,000 a year, so we were doing quite good plays. Yeah. And we were getting coverage for those, and then a big musical came to New Zealand and they asked me if I wanted to publicize it. And I said yes, because I had a problem turning anything down. Being a freelancer, you're always kind of like, oh, I need some money.
Yeah, I just yes to everything because it's going to earn money. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yes to everything. So we did this musical and it got an enormous amount of coverage. And then we got offered a contract working for an organization called Community and Public Health to publicize World Smoke Free Day. And again, we didn't say no to anything. So we took that on board, and to do the marketing and the communications work to promote that event in New Zealand. And that just led to more and more work because we were quite successful at that. We started working on hepatitis C campaigns. All the while we were still producing theatre and selling adverts, I sort of would go to bed at about 1 o'clock in the morning and get up at 5 o'clock the following morning. Yeah. It was sort of manic.
That probably wouldn't have been good for your medical phobia as well.
No. It was all pretty exhausting. But sort of, I guess one thing led to another. We were touring a lot of work, getting a lot of coverage. People loved the creativity of our campaigns. Just through a lot of the health work that we were doing, I was learning how to lobby as well. Because there's actually, oddly, a large amount of lobbying. And New Zealand passed a Smoke-Free Environments Act in 2004, which we had played quite a lot of... That must be earlier than that, because I'd finished by 2004, that I'd worked quite a lot on. And then the first year that rolled out, we developed a new quit service that rolled quit services out in the workplace using GP nurses. So we developed a new product and a new service that we would take to factories and so on to roll out to increase the quit rates, because we wanted to leverage the Change in the Environment Act, Smoke-Free Environments Act, to increase quit rates. That was my crash course in actually how marketing and communications works in the real world. I'd been successful, and then I got offered a senior role at Auckland Theatre Company when I was 27, and it's all gone from there.
You mentioned early on about the sales side of things. Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself as a natural salesperson when you were, you know, put in front of people, or was it the fact that you were selling something that you were so passionate about, or was it both?
I wouldn't have said that I'm a natural salesperson, but I think I came across as being quite genuine and authentic, and I wouldn't put forward a campaign that I didn't think could work. But I think I was probably more passionate about being the radio station that we worked for, and it was really cool. And the station continues to have a really great relationship with its listeners. So we were selling a product that we were, or a station that and a channel that we knew did work and had a lot of, and people cared about, and people understood that. Advertising was a necessary kind of part of keeping that station going. And a lot of the people who bought our advertising would be listeners of the station anyway. I think as much as anything, I was passionate about what we were doing, and that kind of generated enthusiasm. We were coming up with great creative ideas and great creative concepts. As much as selling adverts, we would be selling a creative idea, and a business would be really excited about the fact that over the course of a year we were going to roll out a murder serial based in a bookstore, working through sections of the bookstore each week, and talking about the various kind of titles and so on, that and dovetailing with the sales promotions of that bookstore. If you're selling a creative idea like that, it's not so much here's X amount of spots on the radio station. It's here's an amazing creative idea that people are really going to enjoy seeing how the story unfolds over the course of a year. This is how much it'll cost us to write it and air it for you.
Right, right. So you're selling the idea rather than the actual time on the radio station.
Yeah. I think the time on the station is probably a little bit boring in a way. And you might be talking about demographics and listenership, and we didn't necessarily have a huge listenership being an independent radio station, but we had amazing ideas, and the people and people actually listened to and remembered particularly that series, The Murder Mystery, in the bookstore.
Your time at Auckland Theatre Company, transversed. That's traversed. The word I was kind of traversed. There we go. So it's late in the afternoon. My brain's dead. But the Facebook launch and the social media upheaval and all those kind of things. So you'd started before all that, you know, appeared, and then you were there through that time. Did that drastically change the way that you were communicating with people?
It did. Auckland Theatre Company was one of the first companies in New Zealand to start selling tickets online. So the company in and of itself had been is quite an innovative company and embraced new technology. All the time we used a lot of when I started at Auckland Theatre Company, we had just created a new initiative using text messages at the time. Embracing new technology had always been a major part of the company's ethos. The tricky thing for a subscription company of the kind of Auckland Theatre Company is that it does have an older core audience for Auckland Theatre Company that's over 45. At the time when Facebook was kind of coming out, it wasn't. We didn't have a huge kind of following to begin with, and our audience, a lot of people will still want a hard copy of a brochure sent to them, and they'll fill in a form and they'll post it back to us. So we didn't necessarily see it as a channel that was going to create a lot of ticket sale revenue for us. It was more we wanted to be able to be accessed and to create conversations with people, and for people to feel that they could be close to us. And so that was how we embraced a lot of the social media to begin with, was simply as a channel that people could start a conversation with us.
How do you find it today with Brisbane Festival? What, I mean, obviously, you know, no event is ever created without some sort of social media presence these days.
Yeah, and we have,
what works well for you guys and what doesn't work well?
We have a big team here as well, working on digital and digital realm as well. If we create an extraordinary piece of content that people want to watch and share and engage with, that will go very, very well.
Give me an idea of something like that. Is it something that you're stumbling on, or are you deliberately creating it?
No, we'll create it quite deliberately. So it might be the launch of, say, a new or part of our music program and contemporary music program. Brisbane, if you don't know, Brisbane has an enormous contemporary music scene, and particularly really kind of punk, hardcore, rock, underground, indie scene here. The program, because we want to be relevant to the people of Brisbane, we have a big contemporary music aspect to the program. So when we're launching the music program, that will create great video content just to launch that. And of course, when we've got a lot of big names involved and a lot of Brisbane bands, that starts to get people chatting about it, sharing it, inviting their friends to it. And we're really adamant and encourage the artists that are working with us to engage with those campaigns as well. So it's not just Brisbane Festival trying to connect with an audience via its Facebook channels, but all of the bands that we'll be working with are also driving that piece of content, because the bands are and the artists are generally the people who have the credibility with an audience, and we're just connecting those two people together at a time and place. So to be successful for us, it'll be a great piece of visual content that has good music, really, really good visuals of concerts and gigs, so that people can get a sense of what the experience that they're going to have when they go to a gig is going to be like. And we have the amplification of all the bands themselves. That's really big for us. The most extraordinary and surprising thing for us in terms of really well-shared content is anything for us that is talking about how fantastic Brisbane is. There's a great sense of Brisbane pride, and Brisbane Festival is a key driver of that. We are very keen to endorse and support the Brisbane Pride kind of movement. So it can be as simple as some beautiful images of the city where our festival the festival is taking place. So we had a big light and laser spectacular taking place on the river. There are fountains and lasers and so on. And we'll take amazing photos of that, but we'll have extraordinary kind of cityscapes in the background. And the engagement with that kind of city pride imagery took us by surprise how many people would share that, like that, comment on it, take it and repurpose it for their own ends.
What channel works best for you guys? I mean, if you had to take one away, what would you not be sorry to see the back of from a social media perspective?
We'd probably drop Twitter, I guess. It's the channel that gets us the least engagement. I kind of think of the channels having different audiences and a different purpose for us, though. So on Twitter, there's a lot of journalists and there are a lot of media. So we might be putting out news angles and bait for a journalist, whereas through Instagram, and which is really visual, and we might be heading out with that great kind of Brisbane Pride stuff, or we might be going out with band stuff. On Facebook, we might be running more kind of competitions and longer form content, which has deeper engagement and is directly connected to the event and so on. So those different channels for us have different targets, different audiences, and so we try to be and tailor the messages accordingly. But I guess if anything, we would drop Twitter, because we can just pick up a phone and talk to a journalist.
Outside of social media, what other channels work for you guys, or what do you what gives you the best ROI or the best eyeballs on what you're doing?
Our email lists, which are pretty heavily segmented and targeted, are really, really valuable to us.
Give us an idea about how many you would have on an email list and how you segment them, because I think this is a major problem with a lot of people in marketing, that they've just got, and people in business in general have just got a long list of emails and don't really kind of spend any time understanding who the people are, or whether they should be in groups and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got about 150,000 people actively on our email lists. We have an opening rate of around sort of in the mid-40s generally for an email.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. So, so the way that we would segment, there's lots of different ways that we can segment. We can segment it by art form. So just people who go to theatre, people who go to popular music, and so on. We might segment based on genre. So not only do you go to theatre, but you like dramas or horrors or thrillers, or if you like music, maybe you are actually into string quartets or orchestral music or popular music, jazz, blues, whatever. So we can segment those ways. We can also segment by venue. We have, I think I mentioned before, a lot of different venues that we use, and people do tend to be in the arts quite loyal to a venue. It is quite a challenge actually to get people to explore new venues, as it's as hard to get someone to try a new venue as it is a new type of art form.
Right.
We'll keep kind of chipping down, saying, okay, we want theatre audiences, but not just theatre audiences. We want people who go to horrors, but we want people who goes to horrors at the Queensland Performing Arts Centre, or we want people who go to horrors at La Boite or Powerhouse. So we just keep cutting it down and cutting it down. So that is probably one of the biggest and easiest ways to segment. And I guess that's based on former purchasing behaviour. If you've exhibited an interest in an art form and a genre before, we're going to assume that you had a great time at that and you might want to do that again. There are other segmentation models that we use as well, and which are a little bit more sophisticated and require kind of surveying to build. There's an English company based in Manchester called Maurice Hargreaves McIntyre, who have developed a segmentation model called Culture Segments that we make great use of. And that looks at different not only what art form somebody would like, but it looks at the kinds of things that will motivate somebody to go in a different segment, and when in a purchase or in a campaign, those people are most likely to be to have their interest piqued.
So it's highlighting people that would be likely to shift to a different venue or a different type of art form and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It does do that, and the segmentation models also will kind of give you a pretty good indication of that a certain segment just doesn't like musicals, or a certain segment like theatre. So only put the musicals towards those.
Can you just before you go, what was the name of that? What was the name of? Is it like a piece of software that you can subscribe to, or how does it?
Maurice Hargreaves McIntyre is the name of the consultancy. Culture Segments is the particular tool. They provide you with questions that you ask and bury into surveys, and then based on the response to those questions, you upload the data into a tool that tags records with the segment. Yeah, it's really cool. We used it a lot at Auckland Theatre Company, and then I introduced it when I started at Brisbane Festival, so that a lot of the thinking I could just roll out here that I'd cultivated in New Zealand.
Yeah.
But I think some of the stuff when you're getting into arts marketing, and I don't know how specific, given you've got probably quite a general listenership.
No, well, it's useful to know how different sectors do them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's why you're here, my man.
Oh, good. Okay. So if we were to talk about what motivates somebody to go to or have an artistic experience, there are generally, you can group motivations into four types. People will go to, most obviously, for social reasons. So they want to catch up with their friends or their family. They want to have a meal and drinks afterwards or beforehand, or even during if it's a gig. People will go for emotional reasons. They want to be moved by something. The work will require a storyline, and they'll be swept away by the grand emotions of a work. People will go for intellectual reasons. They want to be challenged to think in new ways. Maybe they know an art form really well, and for argument's sake, they might be trained as musicians. And if they'll go for intellectual reasons because they want to kind of hear how an orchestra is going to be working with a piece of Shostakovich, and that'll be different from how another orchestra does it, and they know all about the harmonic structure of that work, and they can get into it in an intellectual level. And then finally, people go for what are called spiritual reasons, and that's where we talk about people would say, for argument's sake, that a piece of music was transcendent for them, that they go because it's soul food for them. It gives them a sense of purpose and a sense of who they are and what their place in the world is. So there's those four key motivating factors. Different art forms have different clusters of those. So theatre tends to get people who go for social reasons and emotional reasons. Classical music, orchestral music, and museums and art galleries get a lot of people who go for intellectual and spiritual reasons. So different. Gotcha. So kind of that's how the cultural segments are kind of knowing which art forms are probably going to work with which segments, because they're trying to, at a base level, to understand what it is that motivates different types of people to go to different types of work. And then there's also another, it's sort of built into culture segments as well, but there's another kind of tool of theirs called the audience builder model, and that tries to take into account the sense of perceived risk that people might have with an artwork, and also how frequently they attend and how frequently they have cultural experiences. So if you can imagine, I'll talk about theatre because it's absolutely what I know best. So a new work by an unknown author is perceived by people to be very risky, because it doesn't have a track record. It might be bad. They've never heard of this person. They might be an awful writer. And then you'll kind of have graduations through to a work, say, like Cats or Les Mis, which is an established work with a track record where people kind of pretty much when they hear that name, they know exactly what type of show they're going to get. And so that is perceived as being low risk. So if you start to map somebody's propensity for risk and to try things before it's got a track record, then you're starting to look at things over a diffusion of innovation. So people who are thrill seekers and early adopters, but who also sort of tend to go for intellectual and emotional reasons, will be one segment. And then if you get people who go to work only, who are laggards, who only go to work once it's got a really established track record and a lot of endorsements, and are probably going for more sort of social reasons to be entertained and maybe to be sort of transcended by a beautiful piece of music that makes all their hair stand on end. So for a spiritual kind of reason, that'll be a different segment. So the cultural segmentation takes all of that stuff into account. Right. So once we start to know and can segment our audience by that as well, we can then start to pitch shows in different ways. So we can use different words. We can use different images. We can focus on different editorial stories that might surround it. We can focus on different themes, and then target that specifically. And then again, as we segment our email database, to go back to how we originally got onto this point, then we can send out quite specific information so that we're sending really relevant kind of messaging to people about the kinds of shows that they like, trying to resonate with the reasons that we suspect from all these surveys and so on, what it is that they might actually be seeking from an artistic experience.
And I'm guessing, given you doing all of that work, that mm-hmm. that's what leads to the 40% plus open rate for your emails.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We're not just bombarding people with an irrelevant offer or at a time when they're not interested. So, yeah.
From a technical perspective, then, how are you? What software do you guys use? I'm going to get this is where we get a bit nerdy. What software are you guys using in the background there? Is there specific email programs, CRMs, automated marketing programs, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So there's sort of a big ecosystem that we use. If we start where we collect the data from, that's a ticketing system. We use a system called Enter, which through a license with a provider called Qtix, which is like Ticketmaster or Ticketek or whatever. So that's how we collect a lot of data to begin with. We then have APIs that draw that sales data into Microsoft Dynamics.
Okay.
And that's our CRM. And then we use that to, and then we also plug in survey results into that CRM. So we've obviously got a unique identifier for a patron. So if that patron has answered a survey, then we can append segmentational data to that record. And also because we know when you bought a ticket, well, we know what the show was, we know what the art form was, what the genre was. We've made an assessment about how risky we thought it was. So we're already starting to build up a profile of you there. So then once it's in Dynamics, we're just writing different queries to segment that and cut that up in different ways. Then we export that data up into Click Dimensions, and it's through Click Dimensions that we would send the email.
Right. It sounds fairly complicated.
It's not. We've got good people who have put that together. Okay. So for us, it's just clicks of buttons. Yeah. I guess the more important thing for us is not what is sitting behind those clicks of buttons, but what is important for us is that we understand the concepts, the marketing concepts that we're working with. So it has been designed for us, but it's we've said that's because we want to be able to talk about art forms and genres and the audience builder model and the cultural segmentation stuff.
Yeah. If you're, I mean, I guess, you know, you've obviously had a history in marketing. You must get people with other businesses outside of the arts that ask you for advice and things like that. What are some of the things that you would, you know, if you were sat in front of small businesses that weren't in the same industry as you, what are some of the key kind of things that you think they should be doing, or things that you see people getting wrong or getting right? What are those kind of basic marketing lessons?
Well, I think the basic marketing lessons that you can learn from anybody who works in the arts is our focus is on experience. And pretty much every business, every interaction you have is an experience that somebody is having of your brand. When I was at Auckland Theatre Company, we worked a lot actually with people working in the area of tourism, which is much the experiential side of that is much more obvious. But even retail, retail is an experience in and of itself. When you're entering a store, you're not just entering a space with products that have prices connected to them, and then you transact, you're walking into an environment, and a human being is having an experience of that space. They're having an experience in every interaction that they have with the people on the floor who are providing them a service. Everything that we're doing is we're thinking about what type of experience is somebody going to have when they come to our show, how are they going to be moved, how are they going to be transformed. And everybody can use in a business where they are actively interacting with somebody, that they are creating an experiential world for somebody. And if somebody has a bad experience, they'll have a negative perception of your brand and of your business. If they have a great experience there, that you know, they walk out feeling good and changed somehow by their interaction with you, and people generally leave the arts changed, hopefully for the better. That is only going to lead to growth in your business. So if you were to work with anybody from the arts and learn from us, it would be the focus on the experience.
The best brands that you see doing that out there outside of the arts. Yeah. Who do you see doing that well?
I think to choose a New Zealand business, Air New Zealand does it extraordinarily well.
I knew you were going to say that, so I had a nagging thought in the back of my head.
It's New Zealand's most trusted brand. But it's an extraordinary end-to-end experience. From the very first interactions you might have with that brand through the website and then their app and then checking in, everything has been designed to make it easy and pleasurable for you. So you're having a great experience. And then after you've checked in and you're in the lounges and you're starting to interact with the actual flight crew and staff on the plane, those people have been trained to act almost like a kind of maitre d's or concierges, and they take really good care of you. And then, of course, provided that the plane takes off at the right time and does land where you were hoping to get to, you've had a great experience of the flight itself. And then if your bags are there and then you leave and you're followed up. So end to end, you've been immersed and an experience with Air New Zealand that has transformed you and improved your regard and perception of who they are as a business. And therefore you want to have that again. And you're connected to the magic of travel and the romance of that.
Yeah. I'm not going to let you get away without picking an Australian brand as well. But is
Oh my God, they don't exist. No, they don't. I was only teasing. Because I've only been here for a year, so the on the ground brands that I've interacted with and had a lot of kind of fun with, I've really enjoyed the Brisbane Lions, and I guess I'm getting right back into that surprised you. Into kind of a live experience and a live spectacle, yes, but it's an AFL team, and they put a lot of effort into not simply the game, but for a spectator in the stands at their games. I keep talking about the idea of being immersed, but that's what entertainment is for me. You get caught up in the spectacle and you're crowd watching and it becomes this extraordinary emotional experience that you have just kind of shouting and yelling. And I have absolutely no idea what is going on in that game. It's a very confusing thing.
I don't think many people have any idea what's going on.
I don't even think Australians know what's going on in that game. Yeah. They bounce a rugby ball and then sort of punt it.
Say they do understand, but I've asked people, I'm going to explain the tackling rules to me, and most of them just kind of look at you blankly and they can't really explain it. Anyway, being a Kiwi, there is only one sport for you, really. So that's, you know.
Well, did you know, not to disparage rugby and the All Blacks at all, but actually there are more people in New Zealand who sing in choirs than play rugby. And
really?
We have a very big Polynesian population in New Zealand, and a lot of the Polynesian cultures are singing as a really key part of their cultural experience. A lot of church choirs. But that does skew the results. But I think it's an interesting fact that more people do sing in choirs than play rugby.
My last two questions for you, otherwise we're going to be here all day. What are you up to next? I mean, obviously you've only been at the Brisbane Festival, as you say, just over a year now. What's the plan for next year? Is there anything that you can tell us about that's maybe different to what you've done this year?
To Brisbane Festival itself?
Yes.
I think we're sort of changing a little bit of our brand focus again. One of our brand aims is to be seen to be Brisbane's festival, not simply Brisbane Festival.
Right.
And that's where the All Together Brisbane invitation to join in comes from. It's, you know, like the when you're singing a song and you're going all together now, that's what All Together Brisbane is about. Are we doing it differently? Are we simply building upon the idea of our public launch? I don't know if you saw that this year, but a lot of arts festivals tend to launch in a very exclusive way to people in the cultural sector and other key and important VIPs. We did provide opportunities for those that sort of speaking presentation to occur, but predominantly the launch took place in the street. It was for the people of Brisbane to interact with, to get a sense of what the festival was going to be like.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to be even bigger on that, in that public launch, and in terms of making ourselves the people of Brisbane, the festival for the people of Brisbane. There are some big, a few more big, broad appeal, easy to access experiences that we've got on the cards in the program. There's a big Brisbane anniversary taking place next year, which happens to occur on the same day as Brisbane Festival opens. So we're connecting with that as well. We will be able to really solidify the notion of Brisbane Festival being Brisbane's festival.
And yourself in the next year, obviously you've only been here a year. Is it more of Queensland or explore more of Australia? Yeah.
But it's a very big country to explore, so I don't know how much of it I'll see, a small percentage. But yeah, definitely.
There's some bits you can ignore, though, so don't feel you have to go everywhere.
Don't have to do every square inch.
Well, I've been here since 2003 and I've never been to Perth, so
It's so interesting coming from New Zealand, because there seems to be a perception, really high regard for New Zealand from Australians, but a perception that we're about 9 hours away. And like, you do realise that Auckland and Wellington and Christchurch and Queenstown, where you can go skiing, it's all closer than Perth.
Yes, absolutely. I think everybody knows that. I just think nobody wants to go to Perth as well. But
I'm really keen to go to Perth. They've got one of Australia's biggest and best festivals, Perth International Festival.
Yes.
For me, so I've got a 2-year contract. I was at Auckland Theatre Company for 13 years, and as you said, went through a lot of different roles, and I don't want to be at another organisation for such a long time. The next thing I want to do personally is I'm kind of looking to continue my travels northward. I'm kind of looking for opportunities in Canada and Europe.
Okay. Yep.
That's where I would like to go. I've done a big producing company, Auckland Theatre Company. I've done a big presenting and packaging company, Brisbane Festival. I'm really keen to work on one of the big touring companies, and which Canada is really famous for. They do a lot of touring throughout Europe and the States. So, yeah, being able to connect with one of those would be quite extraordinary. Yeah.
Sounds awesome. Look, if anybody wants to get a hold of you, where's the best place to talk to you?
I guess you're welcome to email me, michael@brisbanefestival.com.au.
Are you sort of busy on any social media yourself, or?
I'm not a huge. I'm a lurker. I'm on all the channels.
That's quite all right. So if you can, you can find Michael, you can connect with him.
You can connect with me via LinkedIn. Yeah, as well.
That's the biggest challenge, is finding him lurking out there.
Lurking and finding out who you are first.
Mate, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I know it's a long way off, but good luck with next year's festival.
Great, thank you.
And really appreciate you being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for tuning in to the Simon Dale Show, episode number 40. We really, really do appreciate the fact that you listen in every week. As if this is your first time, please go back and listen to some of the others. There are some great interviews, some very high profile people with lots of really important learnings in their interviews. So go and listen to those. Otherwise, we will see you next week.